Chapter 8. Attila in particular. Some kind critic who peruses these writings will, doubtless, have the goodness to point out that the simile of the Mediterranean heath is applied to two personages in this chapter, to Attila and Dorothea, and say, "Saw, the fellow is but a poor unimaginative creature, not to be able to find a simile apiece at least for the girls. How much better would we have done the business?" Well, it is a very pretty simile. The girls were rivals, were beautiful, I loved them both, which should have the sprig of heath? Mr. Cruikshank, who has taken to serious painting, is getting ready for the exhibition a fine piece, representing Fitzboodle on the Erisbig Mountain, County Galway, Ireland, with a sprig of heath in his hand, hesitating, like Paris, on which of the beauties he should bestow it. In the background, is a certain animal between two bundles of hay, but that I take to represent the critic, puzzled to which of my young beauties to assign the choice. If Dorothea had been as rich as Miss Coutts, and had come to me the next day after the accident at the ball and said, "George, will you marry me?" it must not be supposed I would have done any such thing. That dream had vanished forever. Rage and pride took the place of love, and the only chance I had of recovering from my dreadful discomfiture was by bearing it bravely, and trying, if possible, to awaken a little compassion in my favor. I limped home, arranging my scheme with great presence of mind. As I actually sat spinning there on the ground, I limped home, sent for Flusterstickin, the court surgeon, and addressed him to the following effect: "Flusterstickin, says I, there has been an accident at court of which you will hear. You will send in leeches, pills, and the deuce knows what, and you will say that I have dislocated my leg. For some days you will state that I am in considerable danger. You are a good fellow and a man of courage, I know, for which very reason you can appreciate those qualities in another. So mind, if you breathe a word of my secret, either you or I must lose a life." Away went the surgeon, and the next day all Kalbsbrutton knew that I was on the point of death. I had been delirious all night, had had 80 leeches, besides I don't know how much medicine. But the Kalbsbrutteners knew to a scruple. Whenever anybody was ill, this little kind society knew what medicines were prescribed. Everybody in the town knew what everybody had for dinner. If Madame Rumpel had or sat and died ever so quietly, the whole society was on the qui vive. If Countess Pultisky sent to Berlin for a new set of teeth, not a person in Kalbsbrutton but what was ready to compliment her as she put them on. If Piesdorf paid his tailor's bill, or Muffenstein bought a piece of black wax for his mustaches, it was the talk of the little city. And so, of course, was my accident. In their sorrow for my misfortune, Dorothea's was quite forgotten, and those 80 leeches saved me. I became interesting. I had cards left at my door, and I kept my room for a fortnight, during which time I read every one of M. Kotzebue's plays. At the end of that period I was convalescent, though still a little lame. I called at old Speck's house and apologized for my clumsiness, with the most admirable coolness. I appeared at court, and stated calmly that I did not intend to dance any more, and when Klingenspur grinned, I told that young gentleman such a piece of my mind as led to his wearing a large sticking plaster patch on his nose, which was split as neatly down the middle as you would split an orange at dessert. In a word, what man could do to repair my defeat, I did. There is but one thing now, of which I am ashamed: of those killing epigrams which I wrote, mon Dieu. Must I own it? But even the fury of my anger proves the extent of my love. Against the Speck family, they were handed about in confidence at court, and made a frightful sensation. Is it possible? Here happened at Schloss P.M.P.R.N. Kell, a strange mishap our sights to tickle, and set the people in a roar, a strange caprice of fortune fickle. I never thought at Pumpernickel, to see a Speck upon the floor, La Perfide Albion, or a caution to waltzers. Come to the dance, apostrophe the Briton said, and forward D.R.T.H.A. led, fair, fresh, and 23. Ah, girls, beware of Britain's red. What wonder that it turned her head. S.A.T. verbum sapienti. Essence for not marrying. The lovely missus will surely say yes. You've only to ask and try. Apostrophe that subject will quit. Apostrophe says Georgie the wit. I've a much better speck in my eye. Apostrophe, this last epigram especially was voted so killing that it flew like wildfire. And I know for a fact that our charged affairs at Kelp's Britain sent a courier express with it to the Foreign Office in England, whence, through our amiable Foreign Secretary, Lord P.L.M. Ruston, it made its way into every fashionable circle. Nay, I have reason to believe caused a smile on the cheek of our wild eye itself. Now that time has taken away the sting of these epigrams, there can be no harm in giving them. And 'twas well enough then to endeavor to hide under the lash of wit the bitter pangs of humiliation. But my heart bleeds now to think that I should have ever brought a tear on the gentle cheek of Dorothea. Not content with this, with humiliating her by satire, and with wounding her accepted lover across the nose, I determined to carry my revenge still farther, and to fall in love with somebody else. This person was Attila V. Schlippenschlipp. Otho Sigismund Freyher von Schlippenschlipp, Knight Grand Cross of the Ducal Order of the Two-Necked Swan of Pumpernickel, of the Porgay Syphilid of Kelp's Britain, Commander of the George and Blue Boar of Dummerland, Excellency, and High Chancellor of the United Duchies, lived in the second floor of a house in the Schwabskis, where, with his private income and his revenues as Chancellor, amounting together to some 300 L. per annum, he maintained such a state as very few other officers of the Grand Ducal Crown could exhibit. The Baron is married to Marie Antoinette, a Countess of the House of Cardofelstadt, branches of which have taken root all over Germany. He has no sons, and but one daughter, the Fräulein Attilia. The Chancellor is a worthy old gentleman, too fat and wheezy to preside at the Privy Council, fond of his pipe, his ease, and his rubber. His lady is a very tall and pale Roman-nosed countess, who looks as gentle as Mrs. Robert Roy, where, in the novel, she is for putting Bailey Nicol Jarvie into the lake, and who keeps the honest chancellor in the greatest order. The Fräulein Attilia had not arrived at Kelp's Britain when the little affair between me and Dorothea was going on, or rather had only just come in for the conclusion of it, being presented for the first time that year at the ball, where I met with my accident. At the time when the Countess was young, it was not the fashion in her country to educate the young ladies so highly as since they have been educated. And provided they could waltz, sew, and make puddings, they were thought to be decently bred, being seldom called upon for algebra or Sanskrit in the discharge of the honest duties of their lives. But Fräulein Attilia was of the modern school in this respect, and came back from the pension at Strasbourg speaking all the languages, dabbling in all the sciences. An historian, a poet, a blue of the ultramarinist sort, in a word. What a difference there was, for instance, between poor, simple Dorothea's love of novel reading, and the profound encyclopedic learning of Attilia. Before the latter arrived from Strasbourg, whereas he had been under the care of her aunt the canoness, Countess Attilia of Cardofelstadt, to whom I here beg to offer my humblest respects, Dorothea had passed for a belle esprit in the little court circle, and her little simple stock of accomplishments had amused us all very well. She used to sing hers, main hers and Ensovians too, in a decent manner once. Before heaven, I thought her singing better than Chryses, and then as he had a little album in which he drew flowers, and used to embroider slippers wonderfully, and was very merry at a game of lotto or forfeits, and had a 100 small adjournments to associate, which rendered her an acceptable member of it. But when Attilia arrived, poor Dolly's reputation was crushed in a month. The former wrote poems both in French and German. She painted landscapes and portraits in real oil, and she twanged off a rattling piece of Lister Kalkbrenner in such a brilliant way that Dora scarcely dared to touch the instrument after her, or ventured, after Attilia had trilled and gurgled through Navos, or Ipiasur Rosinae was in fashion then, to lift up her little modest pipe in a ballad. What was the use of the poor thing going to sit in the park, where so many of the young officers used ever to gather round her, were? Attilia went by galloping on the chestnut mare with a groom after her, and presently all the young fellows who could buy or hire horse flesh were prancing in her train. When they met, Attilia would bounce towards her soul's darling, and put her hands round her waist, and call her by a thousand affectionate names, and then talk of her as only ladies or authors can talk of one another. How tenderly she would hint at Dora's little imperfections of education, how cleverly she would insinuate that the poor girl had no wit, and, thank God, no more as he had. The fact is, that do what I will I see I'm in love with her still, and would be if as he had 50 children. But my passion blinded me then, and every arrow that fiery Attilia discharged I marked with savage joy. Dolly, thank heaven, didn't mind the wit much. She was too simple for that. But still the recurrence of it would leave in her heart a vague, indefinite feeling of pain, and somehow she began to understand that her empire was passing away, and that her dear friend hated her like poison, and so she married Klingenspor. I have written myself almost into a reconciliation with the silly fellow, for the truth is, he has been a good, honest husband to her, and as he has children, and makes puddings, and is happy. Attilia was pale and delicate. She wore her glistening black hair in bands, and dressed in vapory white muslin. She sang her own words to her harp, and they commonly insinuated that she was alone in the world, that she suffered some inexpressible and mysterious heart pangs, the lot of all finer geniuses, that though she lived and moved in the world she was not of it, that she was of a consumptive tendency, and might look for a premature interment. She even had fixed on the spot where she should lie. The violets grew there, she said, the river went moaning by. The gray willow whispered sadly over her head, and her heart pined to be at rest. Mother, she would say, turning to her parent, promise me to lay me in that spot when the parting hour has come. At which Madame de Schlippenschlipp would shriek, and grasp her in her arms, and at which, I confess, I would myself blubber like a child. As he had 6 darling friends at school, and every courier from Kalbsbrotten carried off whole reams of her letter paper. In Kalbsbrotten, as in every other German town, there are a vast number of literary characters, of whom our young friend quickly became the chief. They set up a literary journal, which appeared once a week, upon light blue or primrose paper, and which, in compliment to the lovely Attilia's maternal name, was called the Kardafelmkrans. Here are a couple of her ballads extracted from the Krans, and by far the most cheerful specimen of her style. For in her songs she never would willingly let off the heroines without a suicide or a consumption. She never would hear of such a thing as a happy marriage, and had an appetite for grief quite amazing in so young a person. As for her dying and desiring to be buried under the willow tree, of which the first ballad is the subject, though I believed the story then, I have at present some doubts about it. For, since the publication of my memoirs, I have been thrown much into the society of literary persons who admire my style hugely and eagerly. Though some of them are dismal enough in their works, I find them in their persons the least sentimental class that ever a gentleman fell in with. The willow tree. Know ye the willow tree whose gray leaves quiver, whispering gloomily to yon pale river? Lady, at eventide wander not near it, they say its branches hide a sad, lost spirit. Once to the willow tree a maid came fearful, pale seemed her cheek to be, her blue eye tearful. Soon as she saw the tree, her step moved fleeter, no one was there on me, no one to meet her. Quick beat her heart, to hear the far bell's chime toll from the chapel tower the trysting time. But the red sun went down in golden flame, and though she looked round, yet no one came. Presently came the night, sadly to greet her, moon in her silver light, stars in their glitter. Then sank the moon away under the billow, still wept the maid alone there by the willow. Through the long darkness, by the stream rolling, hour after hour went on tolling and tolling. Long was the darkness, lonely and stilly, shrill came the night wind, piercing and chilly. Shrill blew the morning breeze, biting and cold, bleak peers the gray dawn over the wold. Bleak over moor and stream looks the gray dawn, gray, with disheveled hair, still stands the willow there the maid is gone. Domin, domin, sing we a litany, sing for poor maiden hearts broken and weary. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.